Today's episode of The Thriller Zone is sponsored by Blackstone Publishing and the brilliant new techno thriller 4 Minutes by the number one internationally best-selling author duo, Brian Andrews and Jeff Wilson. 4 Minutes is available now from your favorite bookseller. Welcome to The Thriller Zone. I'm your host, David Temple, and on today's show, I'm honored to introduce you to Luke McCallan. Luke has crafted a gripping historical thriller from a dark horizon. Now, a historical thriller is a first for this show, and I'm confident you'll be fascinated with this story. One small warning, the audio is a bit hinky because Luke is dialing in from France, where he says the Wi-Fi isn't quite top shelf. I think you'll enjoy hearing about his Gregor Reinhardt series that also includes The Man from Berlin, The Pale House, and The Divided City. Please welcome Luke McCallan as we get in the Thriller Zone. I was doing my little test, right, and I didn't know you were there yet.
Yeah, Peter Piper picked a pickle, pickle peppers.
So sorry.
It's quite all right. I'll do off this time.
We might have, it looks like we might have just a wee bit of a delay, but we will be fine. If I don't step on top of you, that'll be great.
So one thing to let you know about, I'm dialing in from France, a wonderful country. Wine shops are a national treasure, Wi-Fi less so. So if the Wi-Fi collapses, it'll be on my end that it's collapsed, and I'll try and move somewhere else in the house and reconnect. Is that going to really mess up your recording?
Well, it will only mess it up if you freeze for that entire sentence like you just did.
Okay.
Your I face. Did, really? But yeah, knowing that you're in a Wi-Fi
stressed
situation will make it happen. Is that a electronic drum set behind you?
Yep. It is. Keeps me sane.
Oh, I am so jealous. I'm like one of these closet drummers since I was a kid. I've never bought a set. I had one little snare growing up, and I thought that was the thing. One snare and one cymbal. But yeah, electronic. That's cool because you can play and not disturb your neighbors, correct?
Well, yeah, it does sound like it's, even if you're playing with the headphones on and you're channeling John Bonham, you still do sound like it's a bunch of demented rats in the walls. Because you can actually hear the sort of the ticka-ticka-ticka-ticka, you just can't hear. So I do get terribly self-conscious about playing it, even around the family. So my acoustic kit's in pieces downstairs. We had a concert the other night because I'm in a group. So I got it out and gave it a whack. It still sounds okay. But the electric kit's what you need. So, it's the best. It's like a halfway house. It's not brilliant, but it's better than whacking ice cream boxes and whatever you have around. Which is how I started, that we all...
You don't have the play like on the pigskin. There's a bounce because it's a rubber pad, but you don't really have that true connection of the play, do you?
Not really. No, the snare, so you see the white of the snare, it's a mesh. It's actually quite good. But the rest of it is hard plastic. So, I mean, it's harder than hitting a normal drum head. But it's not ideal. It's not ideal. But the snare is pretty good. Actually, you get a lot of fun out of the snare. But then you've got all the sort of different, sounds you can pull out of it. There's a module that goes with it. You can plug in your iPod, play along. There's a metronome. There's loads of things on it, half of which I don't use.
I love it. About it. Give me just one quick second. My dog is going to annoy the hell out of me if I don't let him in.
Oh, good up here.
You got to keep it quiet, all right? They're just down on the floor, dude. Down on the floor. He likes to go knock on the door with his nose, and he's kind of relentless. He doesn't stop until I let him in, so I figure I get annoyed or I let him in.
Sounds a bit like a cat.
Well, Luke McCallan, thank you for joining us, and welcome to The Thriller Zone, our big start.
Thank you very much, David. Great to be here.
This is a tremendous book. I love this cover. I'm such a cover fanatic, and this tells an entire story just on the front page and on the front cover, and I really, really like it.
Well, I'm glad you do. It's funny how the cover came together. I mean, I was initially a bit skeptical of it. I thought it looked like it was, Downton Abbey on fire. The Irish driver had just gone through the roof and just decided to wreck his father-in-law's place. But actually, there's enough elements on the cover that that suggest that something a bit more is going on. So I really quite like the sort of the chateau in the middle and then the smoke coming up from the back. I thought the font was brilliant, the red font against the gray sky. But can I give you a sneak preview of something else, right? So that was the American version. This is the British version. I don't know whether that speaks to you. There's lots of division between what works in the US market and what works in the UK side. But this is a continuation of, you know, this sort of silhouette cutout theme, which the British publishers have used on all the books. And there's always something going on the inside. But it's really different, right? Two the same book, two completely different covers.
And that's the original title, is it not? Where God Does Not Walk?
Where God Does Not Walk was the working title that made it all the way to the UK. But in the United States, and I'm not going to tell my publisher, they don't know their business, they said that really won't work too well. So I've had trouble with, not trouble is the wrong word, I've had, you know, issues with all the titles. So I had a couple in my back pocket and I said, here's one I made earlier, here's another one I made earlier. So both actually are titles or lines from poems about the First World War. So they both work really well.
Well, it's brilliant. And it is the first, I can say that this is the first historical thriller that I've had on the show. So I should have some kind of a fancy fanfare. Yeah, woohoo. And I'll maybe make some.
I'd have queued in some classical music for you. And,
It is a fascinating read. And this is book four, right? Because I did a little homework and because I loved that silhouette take on and I'm going to show this on the screen here in post, but I love that silhouette, see-through, multidimensional, telling one story with the silhouette, but another with what's inside. And this is book four, correct?
This is the fourth book I've written, yeah. And so a reader can dive in with this one, because you'll see, you could start at the beginning if you like. But the first three I wrote were actually in the future. So those of you who know your Star Wars will know I've done a George Lucas on you, and I've started with Episode Four, and then I've leapt back to Attack of the Clones or something. No, whatever it was, that awful turkey that they came out with that first Star Wars novel film. So the first three novels were, you met the main character, Gregor Reinhardt. He's already, you know, broken down, embittered, shambles of a man. You know, time has done that to him and various other things as well. And this time around, taking him way back to when he was, you know, a late teen, 19 years old, he had to completely reinvent him, completely new character. It was the hardest thing to do on the book. Even harder than any research I did, was trying to put myself into the mind of a 19-year-old boy, right, in the trenches and faced with, you know, something that's far beyond his reckoning, something he never thought he would have to face up to. So that was really hard. But if an author, I always personally quite like to start at the beginning of an author's work, right? Sure. So even if an author jumps back and forth, a bit like some of the Lee Child novels, you never quite know where you are in the Jack Reacher pantheon in terms of time. Although some of them are clearly indicated, right? But otherwise, I always like to start at the beginning, and I like to watch how an author evolves over time. So I would always recommend, if anyone asks me, and people sometimes do, where should they start? Until the two sequels to From a Dark Horizon written, I'll always say, start at the beginning where I started, and that's The Man from Berlin, and get to know Reinhardt like I did, and watch him grow. And then you have fun going all the way back in time and watching him become someone completely different.
I love that. And that was actually my next question, was how that fitted in the sequence and could I pick it up as a standalone? So you answered that. But I'd love to talk about the creation of this Gregor Reinhardt, because he was a multidimensional character that suffered the horrors of war, and also there was this inner dialogue, almost a psychosis, that I really kind of dug, because I like the dark underbelly of so much. So let's talk about the creation of him.
So he comes, I mean, I guess you must hear this from a lot of authors, right? But it's true, right? He comes out of the subconscious somewhere, right? So I can remember it was sometime in the year 2000. I woke up and he was fully formed as an image of him. And there was a sense of him. And essentially he walked into a dream and he said, my name is Gregor Reinhardt and I am on the edge of despair of what my life has become. And he was, you know, this sort of, you know, very strong image of this sort of silhouette shape, you know, a sort of Humphrey Bogart private eye, rain jacket turned up and a fedora on his head, and there was a cigarette smoking somewhere. And, you know, you wake up and it was vivid, 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 and you scramble around for something to write down that first line. My name is Gregor Reinhardt, and I'm on the edge of despair of what my life has become. And then I had to figure out what it was. And, you know, no one was more surprised than me to find myself channeling a middle-aged German from the 1940s, because I always thought I would write fantasy and science fiction. So the first thing I'm doing is, what is happening? But essentially, the short version, sort of the straight arrow through the story, is that I was working as a political advisor for the UN peacekeeping mission in Bosnia-Herzegovina at the time. And essentially, I began to use him to channel a lot of what I was seeing and doing and feeling, or, you know, not doing, not saying, because sometimes you can't always do and say what it is you want to say and do. And I began to realize that he was some kind of, you know, channel right into my subconscious to say, there is a way to do this, and it's on the pages of a book. Give it a go. And for the longest time, you know, I struggled and shambled around and with this character. And I, you know, there was this long period of, could I not could I do it? I knew I had, pretty sure I had the chops to write. But I, should I? What does it say about me that I'm writing a book in that period with, you know, a German, even though he's not a Nazi, it's still like, what are people going to think about me? So I put it down, looked at it, walked away. Years went by. And finally, I realized that his story was my story. And the story I wanted to say was, in many ways, what I'd like to say about the man from Berlin was a love song for Bosnia, which is a country and the people that I love, came to love very, very deeply. And I initially had Berlin as the setting for this novel, right? I mean, and I was terrified of going to Berlin, and Berlin belonged to Philipp Kerr and Bernie Gunter, and his fans are pretty jealous of the Berlin sidewalks. They kick out, you know, uppity newcomers like me. You get booted off into the cells. So, but then I realized, you know, I've got something to say. I've got something to say about that time, and I have something to say about that place, which is Bosnia and Sarajevo. And then when I realized that, the book just took off and wrote itself in many ways. It was just leapt off the page of me. And so, yeah, there's a lot of me in that first novel. And because I never knew whether I would write another one, I didn't even know that I was writing a novel, David, right? I just did what felt right. And then no one was more surprised than me that I had a novel. And then no one was more surprised than me that I had a novel that someone wanted to publish. And ever since I've been more surprised that people actually read it, buy it and read it, come back for more. So that's kind of like, you know, the short version of where Gregor Reinhardt came from.
Well, and here's a beautiful thing that I like what you just said, and it reminded me. I had Wanda Morris on the show last week, and she was talking about, I was asking her kind of her secret, her theory, her philosophy. And she said, ignore the rules and write the story that appeals to you and that resounds with you and then you feel has come to you in some form that you can't help but tell it. And an audience will find it. And I thought of this when you were saying that, and it's so true. That's point A. Point B is there, and I understand how you feel. A lot of authors feel this way when they think, oh, what have I got to say that fill in the blank famous author hasn't already mastered to the tune of 10 or 15 or 20 novels? And that is this, there's nothing new, nothing original. It's your voice. It's going to be your particular slant on things. And so I applaud you for hanging in there. Cheers.
Yeah, and it was not easy. Yeah, I mean, the guy I read when I first began thinking seriously about, you know, writing historical crime fiction and, you know, trying to basically, I talked to my father and my father in particular, some other friends, people who've read this stuff, and my father devours, you know, crime fiction. So where do I start? What are the origin pieces in this world? So he pointed out a few books. I went a bit further, and then I stumbled across, as you do, pure happenstance, Philip Kerr's Berlin Noir trilogy, which I don't know whether you've read, but if you haven't, I highly recommend it. I mean, Philip Kerr reinvented essentially historical crime fiction from the ground up with that, in my opinion. And when I read it, it kind of froze me into immobility. I thought, no one's ever going to do that period and those issues better than that. So. And I had in mind as well this Tolkien-esque moment, right? Because I always loved science fiction and fantasy. And Tolkien is, you know, he's the mountain on the landscape that everyone tries to either climb or get around. And there's so much derivative stuff, right, in fantasy, so much derivative stuff around Lord of the Rings that you think, oh, but something different, really, would you? And then lately other people have, right? I mean, you know, George Martin's one You know, his writing cuts straight through, and his humor, it's just so fresh to see in that genre. Robert Jordan, even though I wanted to whack Robert Jordan over there with the collected hardbound editions of his books and just say, get on with it. You know, Robert Jordan reinvented. And so there are people who can do it. I didn't think that I could, but I just realized that actually if I took you to the Balkans, I can even say, close your eyes, give me a hand, trust me. I want to walk you through this wild landscape and you're going to enjoy the ride with me. So it was really moving into the Balkans that sort of shifted. That was that, you know, unblocking in my mind that, I could do this. I got things to say that no one else is saying. And that was the moment, the road to Damascus moment.
I find it so interesting that you have such a passion for science fiction, because this is, in my opinion, about as far from that as possible. You know, generally a writer will have a particular bent toward this, and then maybe they'll veer off on this. But to me, science fiction and historical fiction, crime thriller, are opposite ends of the spectrum. So that's a conundrum for me. I like that.
They could, yeah. If you say it like that, yes, you're not wrong. I mean, again, go back to the point, right? No one was more surprised than me that Gregor Reinhardt was the guy I was going to, you know, get my name up in lights on the cover of a book. But if you think about it as well, right? So science, historical fiction, it wants to say something about place and time. And it wants to sort of teach you a lesson about what happened, what could have happened. And in a way, science fiction is the opposite end of it. Like, you're right? The other end is like, what could happen, right? What could happen if, you know, and the best science fiction is one that takes an issue and spins it, you know, into something believable. You know, this one of the science fiction writers I like the most, William Gibson. I mean, I use the phrase 5 minutes into the future science fiction, right? The world is entirely recognizable. But he takes his lives, he just like flips them 90 degrees or whatever and just says, this is what could happen. And, you know, it's in a way, it's world building, right? It's no one's going to say that science fiction writers got it wrong, although sure. The old ones, we now know that, you know, time, their time has come and passed sometimes. What was their future is now our past. But with historical fiction, you got to get it right. At least you've got to like get enough of it right that you can say, I've done my research. I know what I'm doing. This time and place was real. Now let's get on with the story and, you know, enjoy the ride.
And that begs this. You mentioned something in the back of the book in your historical notes, The Dark Horizon. And I love this. Is one man's experience of World War I. But further, you said it could be seen as a coming of age novel, which I felt. But it is not a novel about war. Tell my audience the significance of that statement.
So I didn't want to write a novel that was only about First World War. And there are plenty of them out there. Actually, less than you think, far more about the Second World War. But I didn't want to get sucked into the morass of what people usually associate with World War I, right? Which is, you know, the trenches, the blood, the mud, the slaughter, the futility. I think greater pens than mine have been over that ground and you know, done it. You know, a much greater justice and service than I ever could. So the war is essentially the background to the coming of age, and the coming of age is essentially the breaking of a young man, right? So the character comes out of this broken, you know, by his experiences, not just the war. The war doesn't break him much as the, you know, without giving too much away, the war doesn't break him as much as the betrayal and why he's fighting and who he's fighting for. You know, when the blinkers come off as he stumbles across this conspiracy. So and one man's experience of war is not another man's experience of war. I think I've never been a soldier. I've been a member of a peacekeeping mission, worked with many soldiers. And there are as many interpretations of war, of a soldier's experience of war, as there are soldiers that go to war. You know, some talk, some don't. You know, some are broken, some aren't. Some thrive, some, you know, some just want to get over it. Some can put it behind them, some can't. So it's, you know, it's also a very human condition as well, that it's, so it was really, the war was also the background for something else that I want to talk about, which is, you know, even though I love science fiction fantasy, but the other thing I've always read is history and political science. And these moments, these crux moments in human history fascinate me, many revolutions, the French Revolution, and then there's, you know, the revolutions in France again in the 1830s, 1840s, and there's Russian revolutions, that these pivotal moments, right, when human history is turning, and no one knows what's going to come out the other end. And sometimes we look back on it and we think everyone around knew what was happening. But when you live through a revolution, you don't really know what's going on unless you're directing it. you're more concerned about where your breakfast is going to come from and will your kid come home safe from school. So the revolution, sort of this crux moment in the background as well. So From a Dark Horizon is really about an old world is dying. It's dying in blood and mud, but no one knows what's going to come, what's new, what's going to be birthed new. Some people actively want something different. Some people actively want what came before. And some people want the same, that old world back. But, you know, that old world, you know, essentially got them, us into this. And are they really the people that you want to be coming out, ruling the peace, if you like? So those were some of the things I was thinking about when it was, when I say it's not a novel about war as much as it's about this coming of age, this breaking of man, this sort of moment in an age that doesn't come along too often. I think you and I, when we lived through one, you and I, right, the Cold War, the end of the Cold War, no one knew, no one could see that, you know, we would end up, you know, 30 odd years later in this world. But, you know, the Cold War, we could feel, you could feel tectonic movements all around us, right? Something was happening. And, you know, but everyone, we all lived it differently. And so I think that was the kind of thing that I was trying to get to as well with a bit of writing in the back of the book and then hopefully in the whole experience of the novel as well.
Well, mission accomplished. Now, here's an interesting thought, and I've always kind of prided myself on a pretty stout vocabulary, but an interesting observation, perhaps in my ignorance. On several occasions, I found myself reaching for the dictionary for words because I had no knowledge of some of these, and that rarely happens. That's admitting my ignorance. But have you always had such a robust vocabulary? I know it's kind of a tangent question, but it one that made notes about it a little bit.
Yeah, I could be wrong, but in the sense of, you know, what you were reading when you were possibly stumbling across words you weren't familiar with, I think I was trying to either describe emotion or I was trying to describe landscape, which are two parts of writing just that are really, really, I like to spend time getting to grips with those. You know, the inner monologue, even though I've really sort of shaved back on the sort of the excess, if you read the first novel, like, again, because I never knew, I didn't know what I was doing half the time, I never knew whether I would write another one. I tend to go a bit overboard on the internal monologue because, you know, it's one time only, guys, roll up. But I've shaved that back a lot. But landscape is something that really speaks to me. And, you know, I live in the foothills of the mountains here in this part of France, and it's like, it's something new every day. And I always take a moment to look at the mountains and think about, what am I seeing? How can I describe it differently? You know, there was a famous poem from a book, Permanence at Rest and Permanence in Motion. It's the stone and sea. And I always think about that. So how can you push the envelope and describe these things differently? And then the first couple of novels set in the Bosnian forests, you know, this stuff really speaks to you. This is primeval forest. This is, you know, it's dark under those trees and dark things happen. And then, you know, from the forests of Bosnia, I take you to the ruins for the third novel. And then for the fourth one, it's the wasteland, it's no man's land, but there's got to be more happening in there than just, you know, an empty space where, you know, periodically men run across and get shot. So I think it's this desire to sort of, you know, try and find a different way of maybe describing the same thing, which pushes me. I hope I don't overdo it. I don't mean to. I'm glad you found them. It's a great question. I've never actually thought about it.
No, it wasn't overdone. And any time, you know, when I was growing up, my mom was one of these people that read every single book in the library from a young child. And we used to have this ginormous dictionary. I think it was the Oxford Dictionary. It was just, you know, the size of a Volkswagen. And as kids, you know, if we ever said anything like, well, what's that word or how do you spell it? Go get the dictionary. And we had to go get the dictionary, look the word up. Well, how do I know it if I can't? You'll figure it out. And then stand before the family and say it phonetically and spell it and then, you know, give the definition. And I, you know, at the time it was a pain in the ass, but I realize now all these years later that it was such a phenomenal education because that's where that vocabulary of mine came from.
My dad did something very similar with us. You know, he would always say, get the dictionary and look it up. And I would always say to my kids, they come home from school, how was your day? And I said, you can say anything, but you can't say good, nice, or fine. You know, give me something else. Give me three adjectives that are not good, nice, or fine. So I'm passing the baton on a bit, I suppose.
I like it. I got a two-part question for you. One is, when did you first find your interest and or fascination with historical thrillers? When did that begin? And have you ever wanted to write something like very modern day and very, for lack of a better term, like mainstream commercial crime thriller?
So I'll take your second, the second part first. Yeah, the answer is yes, I do want to write something different. I mean, Gregor's got a lot of mileage left in him. We'll come back to it in a moment. But I would love to write something which is gestating in my mind. I call them, for want of a better word, humanitarian thrillers. And I want to set them in my world, the world of, you know, the United Nations, you know, non-governmental organizations, humanitarian relief efforts around the world. And I want to put an interesting character right in the center of all that and have him, you know, do things. I mean, think about the stuff that we as humanitarian workers, either the places that we work, like Afghanistan or Pakistan or Haiti after the earthquake. Think of the issues that we face, you know, with the reconstruction of a country, facing down war criminals, you know, corruption, you know, abuse of people that we're supposed to protect. Think of the cast of characters. I mean, we've got people from all walks of life, all over the world, working in the aid world, and we meet all kinds of people. So I would love to write, you know, novels like that. I just got to get them past, essentially, the, should we say, the ethics committee at my work, because I think their hair will catch fire. And it has, actually. I've seen them running down the hallway with their hair on fire as I tried to sort of describe, you know, what me, an insider, writing these kinds of novels. It's a big fat no-no for the time being. But I'm, you know, my charm and good looks will eventually wear them down, I'm pretty sure. But on historical fiction, you know, very honestly, David, before I dreamt of Gregor, I didn't really have, you know, much of a interest is too strong a word, but I didn't really know that there was a genre that existed so much. And it's funny because my mum and my dad both devour historical fiction. My mum very much sort of medieval stuff. I don't know whether you know the Brother Cadfael mysteries. It's a medieval monk in a monastery in England, and he solves mysteries, and it's all based, you know, around, you know, very erudite stuff like, you know, his command of Latin or his command of herbs, that kind of thing. Very good TV series, by the way. Highly, highly recommend it. Made by the BBC about 10, 15 years ago. And my dad loves historical fiction. Actually, as I answer this question, I realized the answer to your question was I've always liked it, because now I'm realizing. My dad and I shared a love of the Sharp thrillers. I don't know whether you know the Adventures of Richard Sharp, who was a rifleman in Wellington's army fighting Napoleon in Spain in the 19th century. Fantastic adventures. As a kid, I loved them. And it was made into, in my opinion, a not brilliant TV series with Sean Bean, mediator. And then, of course, the Tolkien, if you like, of the historical fiction is Practical Brian's series about sailing ships, Captain Aubrey and Stephen Maturin, his surgeon, who's actually a spy. They are phenomenal, phenomenal books and literature. I would absolutely say those are pieces of literature. And if you or your readers haven't discovered them, then I, you know, there is miles and miles, or sea miles of reading in the Patrick O'Brien series. You may know that it was one of them, the first one of them was made to a film with Russell Crowe called Master and Commander.
Oh, yeah.
About 20 odd years ago now, but a very good film. It stitches together bits of three or four of the Patrick O'Brien novels. So I think the interest in history, I mean, I loved history, my favorite subject at school. Then I did, you know, I began to dip my toe into the reading, following my mum and dad's footsteps a bit. And then, but historical crime fiction, so that's how I heard your novel, or your question, only came much later. But, you know, historical fiction was a way to sort of, if you like, put meat on the historical bones that you were learning in school, like, you know, the Russian Revolution. Yeah, but what was it like? Well, go read a book about it. Or, you know, or sailing ships, when the Royal Navy ruled the world, what was it like? Well, go read Patrick O'Brien. Well, that kind of thing. Or, you know, what was the French Revolution really like? Well, read Hilary Mantel's novel about the French Revolution. That was what my mother would usually chuck a book at me when I was asking a question like this. So, yeah, always. I mean, like most authors, I'm sure like you, David, I mean, we've got piles of books that we stare at longingly and never get around to reading or read it much later than we think. But they're always there, buzzing around. And
I think it's no surprise that you have had such a fascination with historical fiction, given the love that your parents had. And I find that to be true. You know, I would start reading the books that my mother would read. She would hand them off to me, and then I'd read them, and then I'm like, oh, I like this. And it wasn't until she got into, Amish romance. When she hit the Amish romance, I'm like, I'm out. Sorry.
That's a genre.
That's an actual genre. Amish romance. Yeah.
Amish romance. And I can remember the first adult book I ever read. I can remember it. It was, we were living in Zimbabwe, and it was 1983. And there was an author, he just recently passed away, a guy called Wilbur Smith, who wrote basically novels about Africa. But he wrote one novel called The Leopard Hunts in Darkness. And it was set in Zimbabwe at the time we were living there. And I remember like devouring it secretly giggling with glee. Like, you know, I know what he's talking about. I know, I've been here. I know this. I smelt that. I've touched that. I've been there, and whatever. And I still have that novel. Now, seriously, dog-eared. But it's one of those books. I think we all have them. Every now and then, you just circle back for another read. And you know, huge influence on me, just because it was just different, right? It was different.
And isn't it fascinating, those books that had such an impact early on and became a seminal moment where you just held on to that feeling? And on top of that, the fact that you have lived in so many of the places that you reference brings an authenticity to it that's so amazing that you can't, you know, you often hear you have to go to the place to really experience it. Well, you can do Google flyovers or, you know, all the research you want, but there isn't quite something as visceral and tangible as, you know, the smells of the city, et cetera.
I agree. Yeah. And that was one of the things that the, you know, the writing the fourth novel, you know, From a Dark Horizon, there was a lot of research, and enjoyable research done about it. But again, that's also one of the reasons why I didn't want to sort of write a book about the war, right? Because it's been done, you know, in great depth, you know, and there's a wealth of information out there. But the one bit of research that really sank into the book and sank into the way I wanted to write it was, I've been to the Western Front a couple of times, but I made a point to go there for the centenary in 2018, so November 11th, 2018. I had to be there. And so I actually drove up on my own. I got to the Western Front, the Somme battlefield, quite early, and just drove around. And then I just found myself just before 11 a.m. on November 11th at the memorial to the Welsh Division, which is this really very moving sculpture in iron of a red dragon. So the red dragon's a symbol of Wales. And my mum is Welsh, half my family is Welsh. And it's on a plinth of Welsh granite, and it's looking across a field where the Welsh Division attacked and were, you know, basically cut to pieces on the Battle of the Somme. So I just gravitated there, and it was misty and it was raining, drizzling rather, and then all of a sudden, out of the mists, near and far, right, the bells of all these villages began ringing at 11 o'clock, and, you know, some off, some were in tune. There was one guy that was clearly an expert bell ringer, because he was playing some kind of tune on those bells, and he was, you know, really knocking out that rhythm. And then a couple of people just were there too. They just gravitated. We were all very quiet. We all sort of stood to one side. And then once 11 a.m. was done and the bells were finished, we just came together. And it turned out that one of the men who was there had been the sculptor of the granite blocks that he put up the monument, you know, 20, 30 years ago, and he'd come back for it. But then, you know, when they had all gone and I was on my own again, I just walked over the field, and, you know, you just feel your boots sinking into the mud, and you kneel down and pick it up, smell it, burn your fingers through the grass. You go into the tree, the forest has grown back, but there's, you know, war detritus everywhere. There's rusted shell casings. There's, you know, barbed wire on the ground. You don't have to go very far. All you have to do is stand there and soak it in. And that was, you know, one of the best bits of research I did without really ever knowing that I was doing it. And that was, it was very moving. And the afterword to From a Dark Horizon, I tried to sort of give the reader a little sense of how that felt. But that was, you talk about Google flyovers. I've done those too. You know, when I was doing the third novel, The Ashes of Berlin, and then they visited the city, and they're really useful. I mean, I don't know hats off to our writer forebears, Templar David, who managed to write books without the internet. I don't know how they did it.
Oh, absolutely. And just as you were telling the story there just now, I was walking alongside you. And, you know, that's the results of a good storyteller. I mean, I was smelling it and feeling it and seeing it. You know, another thing that I really enjoyed, and I hope this is a compliment, enjoyed about your book is the vast amount of dialogue. You know, often I have found, and I don't do a lot of historical fiction reading, but what I have, you know, it's steeped in deep atmospheric descriptions and backstory, which is great. But this was so rich and full of dialogue. I mean, it would just be pages and pages of this dialogue. And I love that because I didn't need to have a lot of the history of the room they were in. You gave me just enough that I knew where I was. But it was the double entendres and the secretive underlying meanings. And then the characters would talk about one another in different ways. I thoroughly enjoyed that.
Well, thank you. I think maybe that comes from, you know, maybe trying to sort of, what's the expression? I may get it wrong. Show, don't tell, or tell, don't show. One of the two. With the first novel, Man from Berlin, I was tripping over myself trying to show you, you know, what I knew about the story. So it was maybe flipped around there. It was a lot of exposition, a lot of, you know, hopefully, you know, well written and well flowing exposition. But I wanted you to, you know, see Sarajevo. But I've learned as my writing craft has grown, shall we say, that the real richness is much more in, you know, it's much more in the dialogue. It's in the characters, right? And it's how they express themselves. And I always try as well to give each character a very distinct voice, whether it's uncouthness, whether it's humor, whether it's taciturnness, whether it's, you know, and I try to make sure that, you know, that comes through clearly on the page. And but it is funny, you mentioned that you enjoyed all that. I sometimes find myself reading aloud back my stuff, and I kind of cringe. And I thought, oh God, that's a bit too much. It's funny the way the word sounds perfectly okay in your mind, but then if you speak it out, it doesn't always happen. But sometimes I go back and look at it, and I think, next time, make it even shorter, make it even punchier, strip it back again. And there's a funny anecdote I can tell about some friends of ours in Cornwall, in England. And they used to be as our third guest. They used to live not far away from John le Carré, the great thriller writer who passed away very recently. And it was well known in sort of the villages around that he, you know, where he had his house, that you would often see a crazy man with a shock of white hair blowing in the wind, walking up and down the cliffs, yelling before speaking to himself. And the tourists were told, don't bother him. It's John le Carré, and he's testing out his dialogue. He knows exactly what he's doing. And no, he's not about to jump. And no, he's not going to hurt you. Just stay well clear of him. So sometimes I do take that to mind. And I do actually sort of stop and read out my dialogue aloud.
I've heard this from other people, that it's a good idea to go back and see if the dialogue and the conversations work by reading aloud. However, I do agree with you totally. When you're writing it, all that dialogue and all the words make so much sense in the silence of your head. But I think about guys like, and I often find myself referring to him quite often as Elmore Leonard, the way that he would strip so much out of both dialogue and description. You know, we tend to speak in a shorthand, generally speaking. We don't. Do you suppose you would like to follow me? Do you fancy following me to a place for dinner? You want to go eat? You know. And then the other thing is I've done some number of audiobooks in the past, and I like it when an author will allow the narrator to have a little bit of play in it, in that when you write for the eye, it sometimes translates differently for the ear. And and if you're good at making that adjustment on the fly, like I'm pretty good at, then I think it works for everyone.
So you've done audiobooks, David. My hat's off to you, because I can't say I've listened to many, but when I do, I'm usually, you know, kind of in awe at the the way a narrator takes, you know, takes the book and gives different voice to different characters. And you used to think I would be lost listening to a book, because I would always like to read the, you know, the descriptive text and stuff. I would like to sort of, you know, wallow in that and really enjoy it. But listening to a fine narrator at his craft is quite something. So I doff my hat to you.
Well, thank you. There are a lot of really good ones out there. And I've, some that I've done, I will do a variation on a voice, like, you know, it gets tricky when you're trying to do a woman and you don't bring a woman into the recording session, but it's simple by just lifting your voice and changing, yeah, you know, the way you pitch it. Where it, the real challenge comes, and I could see that on this particular book, is when you have to bring in both textures of characters steeped upon accents, and then if you do a different accent with a different language, then it gets really challenging. But all in all, it is a fun
novel. Yeah, and it's I don't write the novels with a German sort of voice in mind, if you see what I mean. I don't pretend to know enough about Germany and Germans, and I speak atrocious German. So I kind of write them as, you know, I feel them. And I also made a distinct effort, you know, all the way through the novels, to strip out, you know, what a lot of historical fiction writers do in this genre, which is stuff all these German words into the novel. It's like Achtung and Schnell and Haus. Just like, no, it's like, be careful, get out. You know, just like say it like they would say it. Otherwise, I encourage everyone to read it with their own voice in mind. You know, don't get sucked into giving it accents. And to my interest, the British narrator, or the narrator of the first three novels, did exactly that. He didn't try to give, you know, except in a few rare occasions, he didn't give a German accent. He just gave his accent. But he did what you just did, which is modulate his voice differently for each one, which I think works better. Otherwise, I think it just becomes, you know, jarring, and it's not quite. And I would lose some of that authenticity. And again, if you're looking for a universal experience in a way, which is what you're sometimes trying for, all the while, you know, trying to fix the character and place and time and make that place and time unique.
That's a very good point. And I also think, Luke, that you have to give your listener/reader credit, especially if you're setting up, Luke said, la, la, la. And then, what do you mean, David said? I mean, give the reader enough credit that you, if you're setting them up with who's doing the speaking, then you don't really have to color the voices so dramatically, especially if it's in a scene that there's only two people. You don't have to belabor the point with he said, she said. Well, this leads me to another point. So while you're researching to find an audiobook narrator for your next book, I wonder about, do you see any of these books, and this one in particular, of course, as a screenplay? So did you, while you were writing it, and because I'm a filmmaker, also, did you find yourself seeing it as a movie? And did you find yourself thinking, oh, I wonder if I could write the screenplay?
Great question. And less a movie, more of a really good miniseries.
Yeah.
I think a miniseries would make it live much, much better and do more justice to some of the characters. But funny, I have a very, very vivid visual imagination. I see, you know, and again, this goes back to something I mentioned earlier. I see places, landscapes, you know, forests, mountains, this sort of stuff is just imprinted on me. And if you like, I have a sort of sweep of place, time, and landscape in which I write. And I didn't actually write the first one, you know, with that in mind. But when people read it, none of them jumped up and said, this would make a really great film. So I began thinking about it a lot more. It would be, but only from a purely, sense of, you know, personal self-aggrandizement, you know, sort of say, you know, burnish my laurels even more. Like, look, I've got a film or whatever. But if it gets made, it gets made. It'd be wonderful. I mean, I think it would make a great miniseries, like I said. And then the thing that you mentioned, which I find, I often ask myself this as I have a really great admiration for the screenwriter or the screenplay. And you mentioned Elmore Leonard earlier, and he's a favorite writer of mine. But the only time his writing makes sense is when people speak, because the rest of the time I have no idea what the hell's going on in his novels. I mean, I've got this one, you know, This Storm, which I've tried to get into, and I love Elmore. I love James Ellroy. So you mentioned Elmore Leonard. Sorry, I meant James Ellroy. L.A. Confidential. That book is practically impenetrable. I mean, I had a really hard time with it. But I read it after I'd seen the film. And when I finished it, I just sat back in awe at the screenwriters who tugged that red thread out of that book and made it into the film that it was. And I think the film and the book both stand in different ways as masterpieces of their craft. There's another one in France, a novel called Au revoir là-haut. I think in English it's translated as The Great Swindle. And it's about two French soldiers, veterans of the First World War, one of whom has had his jaw blown off. So he's what the French call a gueule cassée, a broken face, literally. And it's how they survive in the after-war period. It's a very big, thick, dense novel. And it's been made successively into a film and a graphic novel, which the French do really well. And the graphic novel is, in a way, you know, because they have storyboarded all out. It's kind of like a screenwriter's attempt or piece of work. Sure. And again, the screenwriter, the artist for that graphic novel just tugged out of that big, thick doorstep of a book, this beautiful graphic novel. And, you know, it's sometimes in the space of, you know, one box of imagery, you would encapsulate an entire chapter of the book. And again, you kind of think, sit back and think, wow. So I think it would be, I don't have any qualms about people taking my work and adapting it. Like, I don't have any qualms about people reading my work and not liking it, right? Once you've read the book, and once I've written the book and it's published, it's your book. You can like it or not. You can engage with me or not. You know, sure. You can, I don't mind. I think I would probably put up a stop sign on my own capacity, on my own limits, on the screenwriters, on the screenplay. And I would probably step back and say, those who can, you do it. Have fun. Have at it. And I would love to see it come to the screen. I mean, I'm not lying. I would love to see it come to the screen.
Sure.
I once put up a question on the website, who would play Gregor Reinhardt? I got some really interesting answers back, actually.
All right, we'll save that because I'm going to pull this back around to the story. So just leave that alone right now. But back to this point about a screenplay, and fortunately, I was able to take my very first self-published novel and turn it into a screenplay and then turn it into a movie myself. But what I would tell you and encourage you is that they are two, and I'm overstating the obvious, they are two entirely different worlds. They're, you know, the book itself is just rich with story and background and setting, et cetera, et cetera. But the people who really get the screenplay are able to, as you said, and I love this, the red thread throughout the whole story, is to be able to plant the essence of the dialogue. I mean, because you're taking, in your case, 500 pages down to about 120, maybe 130 in screenplay. And that is a challenge in and of itself. But the guys who can really do it are as you said about LA Confidential, are masters. But I always find it interesting. A lot of authors say, oh, I'd love to see this turned into a series. And I realize that it's two different writing forms. But I'm surprised at the amount of people, or I guess I'm surprised. I'm kind of surprised that more authors don't find that interesting to be able to try their hand at it. Because I think if you ever try it once, your first one will be horrible. I think my first screenplay attempt was about 220 pages. And I got it to 120, but I think you, with your expertise and your knowledge, I think it would be interesting for you to try your hand at it. Cause I just, you know, fun little exercise, if nothing else.
Why not? Why not? I mean, challenge, I'd like to say challenge accepted. You know, I'll give it a go. I'll give most things a go once within reason, of course. Yeah, why not? Why not indeed?
One of the things that was crystal clear to me is how you've worked your experiences of your vast world travel into the places and characters of your story. And so before we start to wrap, I wanted to ask you about your work with the United Nations, which is on your jacket. Can you share that experience and how you've used that experience to weave it into your ability to tell stories of this depth?
So my current job is with the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees. I guess you could say I'm a reporting officer. So I run the unit that produces the big reports for UNHCR, and by big, I mean, you know, pretty chunky reports. So we are, you know, we're 17,500 staff members in about, you know, 130 countries around the world. We have an annual budget of about $9 billion, and we get about half that in funding. So we've, our reports, I have to sort of do justice to our work and also acknowledge the generosity of our donors and also the countries that host refugees. So there's that's sort of running that unit, and we have an accompanying website that offers much greater detail. Really full-time job, much more so than it has been in the past. So my writing is, I want to say, quote unquote, suffering a bit. I mean, cry me a river, right? I have a full-time job that I love, and it just keeps me away from the writing a little bit too much. But you know, there we go. But the real, so I grew up in this world, right? My mum and dad were both aid workers. My dad was actually in the same organization that I'm in now. He retired about 15 years ago. And I joined about six. So there was no question of nepotism, no jobs for the boys. I joined on merit, you better believe it. And then my mum was a specialist in working with child soldiers. So she would work essentially as a psychologist to reintegrate child soldiers back into society after wars. So I grew up in Africa, then we grew up in, you know, in places like Turkey. My dad worked, you know, other places where he couldn't take us. And I was kind of a bit like, you know, frog in the water. So the water warms up around you. I didn't really know anything else to do. I didn't know anything else that I wanted to do. Only the lodestar or pole star that kept staying with me this whole time was writing. So, you know, between writing and trying to do, you know, wanting to do aid work, those were the two things that I've carried with me all the way. And then really the genesis of the writing, the sort of wellspring that I draw from was that time I spent in Bosnia, those 6 years in Bosnia. And I was in a very privileged and interesting, fascinating, invigorating, heartbreaking, depressing job, best job I've ever done. And I was essentially a political officer for the UN mission. And it was a peacekeeping mission. And it was policemen from all over the world who were coming into Bosnia to essentially oversee and reform and train Bosnian police officers who had been, shall we say, not particularly helpful to their citizens during the war. So my job was to essentially tell them the lay of the land. And I was given essentially an area of the country, and I was given a car and an interpreter, and I was told to get out there and find out what's going on, speak to anyone and everyone about anything and everything. You know, spread the gospel of the United Nations where you can, but otherwise just listen. And, you know, I talked to mayors of cities, I talked to businessmen, I talked to priests, I talked to imams, I talked to women, men, children, I talked to refugees coming back, I talked to, you know, anyone who could give me a sense of what was going on. And you just draw it all together, you knit it all together. And your job was to, at the end of each week, even sometimes if the heat was on, the end of each day, you'd write a small report back to headquarters in Sarajevo and say, you know, I went here, I saw this, I spoke to this person, he said this, whatever. And then in headquarters, they'd be pulling it in. There were like two dozen people like me across the country. And they basically, it's sort of like an intelligence operation, very transparent, very open one. But we were trying to basically keep our finger on the pulse of what was going on in Bosnia so that we would give the best advice we could to our fellow UN aid workers and other colleagues in the country. And then, you know, the traveling around the country was, you know, amazing. Even the area where I was very mountainous, very forested. Some pretty awful things happened there during the war. And then I began to realize as well, you know, one of the things I really wanted to get out of the novels was this: get people away from this shorthand of the Balkans being a byword for treachery and treason. And that, you know, what can you expect from these people? They do it every 50 years, they bloodlet. And I would get really angry and I would, you know, want to push back and say, there's no more life to be prone to bloodletting in the Balkans than they are in Ireland or in Spain or in wherever. You know, blood, it doesn't come out of nowhere. And I would think, well, where does it come from? And I would start sort of, you know, push and ask and think and feel and what happens to make you turn your hand against your neighbor, your 30 years neighbor. You've barbecued with him, you've picked his kids up from school, you've, you know, looked after, you know, his whatever place when he's on holiday. You're like that. And then all of a sudden something happens. And then you throwing a Molotov cocktail through his window, or you're standing by while he's being lynched, or you're doing nothing while his family's being run out of town. Something happens to us. What happens to us in these moments? What can we say about it? And it was kind of going back to one of the first things I was saying earlier in our interview, David, about my interest in history and these crux moments, these moments when things flip, go at right angles. You thought your life would be that, but all of a sudden there's this hard fork, hard left in the road. And sometimes you don't want to take it, right? You don't want to throw a Molotov through your neighbor's window, but there's some big bearded smelly guy with Nikki 47 standing behind you, and he's got that gun pointed at your head, and he's saying, if you don't throw that Molotov, then you're in trouble. Because you're one of us, right? You're one of the big bearded folk, or you're one of the short swarthy folk, or you're one of different, you're not like him. You know, you're not as good looking as David Temple is. you don't have an apartment as beautiful as his is. And so basically, check that Molotov, check it to the computer screen. So it was like, what happens to people who do that, right? And I haven't got an answer. I have a lot of, I have something of an answer, and I have something of a journey to take you on, if you like. But that's really where the two things began to fuse together, right? The sort of the job that I was doing, trying to sort of understand the country and knit the country back together, trying to do my best for that country. And then the storytelling urge, which was, my God, there's some stories to tell here. There's some, amazing things to say and talk about. There's universal experiences to sort of talk about. And then this amazing country, Bosnia, this sort of passionate, wild, welcoming country where I was happy for 6 years and my family were happy for 6 years. And I hope you find it, in the pages of at least the first two books. But then, the rest of it's a bit more of a bumpier ride. Post-war Berlin and the trenches in 1918. So, does that make sense, David?
Makes total sense. Yeah. And I love the fact that you're blending this storytelling, report journalism with humanitarian focus, which leads you to this expertise of storytelling. Well, the Gregor Reinhardt series includes The Man from Berlin, number one. Two is The Pale House, The Divided City, and of course, From a Dark Horizon. As we get to wrap it up here, I like to do this thing just called rapid fire questions. Some of them are really super silly, easy, and others are a little more complex. And as you referred earlier, one of those is already hidden in here. So we'll start off with an easy one. Number one, number two, coffee or tea?
Tea.
Of course. Pen and paper or keyboard?
Keyboard.
Music or...
Again, going back to how our ancestors did this, I don't know how they kept their thoughts going with their pen.
I talk to so many people who will write their first draft, and I know that James Patterson does this. Several people have had on the show, and I'm like, my hand can't possibly keep up with my brain, and it cramps out after an hour anyway. So, yeah. But this I can do all day long. Yeah. Music or silence when writing?
Music, actually. Yeah, always music.
Oh, you're one of the first. And can you share a particular genre, if not a particular artist?
Anything that really, it's sort of the mood of the moment, really. I mean, it depends what I'm writing. But I usually like to have, my Dire Straits playlist. There's he's a great storyteller, Mark Knopfler. I really love his shorthand when he's writing. I mean, Romeo and Juliet, that song. I mean, it's just like, I don't know how he does it. Who else have I got? Led Zeppelin. When the going gets tough, I usually like stick on a bit of Zep.
I love it. You're a man of many talents and many interests. I love that. This one's a little more complicated. It's not quite as rapid fire. You've been asked to host a roundtable discussion in front of a live audience, and you can invite three or four people, whichever pop into your head first, to interview, either as research for an upcoming book or for simple pleasure, and they can be dead or alive. Who would they be and why?
I would love to have Patrick O'Brien. So he was the author of the Aubrey and Maturin series, The Master and Commander.
Yes.
I mean, I just think he's a great raconteur. He's a very very dark, very wry sense of humor, very sly sense of humor in his novels too. But he also he'd be fascinating to speak to because he wrote a lot of his books based upon ship's logs. he got them. I don't know where he got them from, but when he passed away, eventually in his house, there were hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of ships logs, merchant ships, warships, modern ships, old ships, you name it. So he has all this sort of firsthand information. So I'd love to have him along. Who else could we have along? Stephen Fry, maybe, you know, the actor Stephen Fry.
Sure.
Or in the same genre, maybe Winston Churchill. I mean, let's have him. He'd probably drop a few zingers into the conversation. But, you know, someone to sort of keep us all on our toes with our, you know, with sort of double entendres and a bit of slight humor. Why not? Okay, here we go. Here, one more.
Patrick O'Brien, Stephen Fry, maybe Winston Churchill will make it number four.
Well, seeing as we're sort of talking about the, I mean, I'm just, you really stumped me here. I ought to have a good answer to these things, but you never do. These are great questions. And I would, let's have the unknown soldier. Oh. Let's have the unknown soldier join.
That's beautiful. Okay, perfect. Last question. Your novel, From a Dark Horizon, has just been optioned for the making of a film. Huh, look at that.
Who knew?
Yeah. Perhaps Christopher Nolan could direct it, just saying. And you, Luke, have been hired as an executive producer. And you've also been asked for suggestions on who will play the lead. See, we come full circle. Gregor Reinhardt. Who would you dream of playing him and why?
The young Gregor Reinhardt, right? What we're talking about. Yeah.
Oof. You can pick whatever age you want.
I got a couple. When I was first writing Gregor Reinhardt, in my mind, I had a British character, an actor called Bob Peck, and most of you will know him as the guy who gets gobbled up by the velociraptors in Jurassic Park. He's the big game hunter.
Yes.
But he was in a TV series in the 1980s called Heart of Darkness, which was later a Mel Gibson movie. But in Heart of Darkness, he channels the sort of the anguish of this father who's lost his daughter, and he's trying to understand what happened. So Bob Peck had the face of Gregor Reinhardt. Later, Viggo Mortensen, sort of, I think about him. And then much, much later, because of some of the roles he played in films like Hostiles or 310 to Yuma, Christian Bale could pull it off, I reckon. But he would have to be the grizzled Reinhardt from the 1940s. The fresh-faced young chap, you know, I really don't know who would play him.
That's okay. You've given me two impeccable. I mean, Viggo Mortensen, one of my all-time favorite actors. He can disappear into any role with reckless abandon. And Christian Bale, for crying out loud, I've seen him do some work that I'm like, where did that come from? You know, we have run out of time. But Luke, thank you so much for taking this time out of. What time is it in France right now?
It's coming up on 8 o'clock in the evening. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah, my day's starting, yours is ending.
Yeah, sun's over the yard arm, and I think I've earned a drink.
Yes, you have, and I would join you if it weren't for the fact that I have way too much yet to do. Folks, if you'd like to learn more, it's Luke McCallin, MCCALLIN.com. Luke, I did go searching for you on both Twitter and Instagram, and I couldn't find you. I found you on a hashtag of Luke McCallin with all your books on it, but I didn't find you.
Yeah, I am, unlike you, David, I am lousy at social media. I kind of run a mile. I mean, I'm on Facebook, so Luke McCallin, author. You'll find me on Facebook. I was on Twitter, but I just couldn't handle it. It wasn't for me. And Instagram, yeah, my kids keep saying, why the hell aren't you on Instagram? And I keep saying to them, well, why don't you do something for me on Instagram if you love your daddy that much? But I am lousy at this stuff. I have a website which is more or less up to date. But if anyone wants to keep up with what's going on, the Facebook page is the place to go. I do apologize for that, because I do know that Facebook is so, whatever, half century or something like that.
It's all good. But Facebook's the best place. You know, you can learn everything you want to know about him on the LukeMcCallin.com. But once again, Luke, this has been tremendous. And I'm blessed to have had the time with you.
Well, thank you, David. Thanks for reaching out. And I really appreciate it. And keep up the good work. I mean, I've, you know, dipped in and out and listened to a few of your podcasts. I think you're doing great stuff. And I've learned a lot. You know, I've got my reading list just got a lot longer from listening to some of your stuff. I really enjoyed the one you just did with Mr. Westmoreland. And so I'm going to be picking up his stuff. And yeah, you mentioned a few authors in there, the sort of Southern crime, which I'm starting to get really interested in. Ace Atkins was interviewed by another podcast I listened to, and I went out and bought the first Quinn Coulson book. straight away and read it. Just finished it in the last couple of days. So yeah, I'm learning so much. I'm learning about writing. I'm learning about writers. I'm learning about books. I'm learning about how, you know, people like you pull this off. And it's great what you're doing for us. So thanks a lot. Hats off to you.
Well, thank you. I'm very humbled by that. And that truly, Luke, means the world to me, because that is really my whole mission. I'm taking, you know, a former experience and expertise of my first career of radio and my love of books. And what better thing in the whole world than to sit down with guys like you, talk about books and what inspires you. And then I've learned all these different authors. And as I was telling Mark, I've got just stacks and stacks of books, and trying to go through them every week to be able to really speak intelligently, and I hope I do that, is, you know,
also good.
Well, it's quite a job, but it's guys like you that make this all very, very easy, and those are very nice words.
Thank you.
All right, well, it's time for you to go get your cocktail and my third or fourth cup of coffee, and then until we speak again, thank you for doing all you can for the Thriller Zone by just spreading the love as you just did.
Count on me. Count on me, David. And if I can say, it's never too late to put a splash of whiskey in that coffee.
You all know, right. maybe that would help this little cough of mine.
Yeah.
It's medicinal only, right?
Purely medicinal. Purely medicinal. Yeah. All right.
Cheers.
Thank you. Cheers.
Thanks, Luke. I think we both learned a lot. Okay, now for next week's show. Yet another completely unique guest. And not only that, but we're keeping our show international, as I welcome Janosch Neumann, a former Russian NSB counterintelligence officer who was appointed by the Russian government to supervise multi-billion dollar international money laundering operations for the Russian state and state officials. What? Yes, Janosch and his wife Victoria defected from Russia and was brought to the U.S. by the CIA, where they were consultants for a variety of U.S. agencies, helping with investigations related to Russian intelligence operations, money laundering, and the fight against Eurasian organized crime groups in U.S. and Europe. I know, right? Their Red Atlantis graphic novel is what they call their shadow parallel reality, and is an animated thriller that's inspired by true events with references to real characters and recent geopolitical situations. It's a lot of words to say that this show with Janosch on Friday the 17th will be unlike any interview I've ever created, and sure to get plenty of attention. So if you're a fan of graphic novels, as I am, you're in for a real treat. Okay, that's it for now. I'm your host, David Temple, and I've got some reading to do. So I'll see you next time on The Thriller Zone.
The Thriller Zone has been presented by Blackstone Publishing in the exciting new techno thriller 4 Minutes, now available from your favorite bookseller. Learn more at blackstonepublishing.com.